Good morning. If you have your Bible with you, would you open it with me, please, and turn to the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 7 is where we will be this morning, and we'll be looking specifically at verse 10, but we'll also read a few other verses in the context here in Ezra chapter 7, if you'll turn over there, please. There are a couple of gentlemen going around with handouts for the lesson this morning. If you desire one of those, just make it known to them, and they'll be sure and get one to you. It has a number of things that we'll be discussing this morning, and then also a little activity for you on the back after the lesson is done. So if you want one of those handouts, just indicate it to one of these gentlemen, and they'll be sure and get it to you. But we'll read here in just a moment from Ezra chapter 7 and verse 10. Though it's not unheard of, it certainly is unusual for a book that is named for a character not to include that character for the first 60% of the book. But that's the case here with the book of Ezra. In Ezra, we see in the first six chapters, Ezra is not even born yet, and it discusses the children of Israel returning from Babylonian captivity to Jerusalem and the trials and troubles that they went through in rebuilding the temple of God that they might reinstate worship to God once more. And in chapter 7, after those six chapters of history, of background, we see 50 years later the character of Ezra is introduced. And Ezra is one of those characters where there's very little negative to be found about him. And the reason for that is summarized well here in verse 10 of Ezra chapter 7. It says, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to study the law of the Lord, and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel." There are four things that Ezra did in this verse. And what are they? Well, we just look for our verbs, for our action words, right? He prepared his heart. He studied the law. He did it. And then he was willing and able to teach others also. And may I suggest this morning that we need to emulate Ezra in this. We need to follow after his example, and all of us should be preparing our hearts to study the law of the Lord, to do it in our own lives, and to be willing and able to teach other people also what the law of the Lord is, what the statutes and ordinances that God has for us today truly are. What does it mean to emulate someone? And perhaps more specifically, how is emulating someone different from imitating someone? Is that just semantics? Well, maybe. But emulating has a little bit different thrust to it. It has a little greater meaning, I believe. Think about it in this way. An Elvis impersonator can don a wig, and he can stick his lip up, and he can sing Blue Suede Shoes. And he might look, and he might even sound a little bit like Elvis. But he's not the king. An imitation always falls a little bit short of the original, right? But on the other hand, if some young boys in Great Britain hear Buddy Holly and the Crickets and decide to name their band the Beatles and imitate his sound and even more try and imitate who he is as singer, songwriter, and musician, that's emulating someone. Emulating means that you're putting forth effort and energy not just to be kind of like someone, not just to be a cheap copy of someone, but to try and reach or even exceed the one that you're imitating. And so we have a large task in front of us if we're going to try and emulate Ezra, especially as it relates to this first thing that we see here in our text in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 10. And preparing our hearts. Ezra is introduced on the scene back there in verse 1 with his family, with the genealogy. This identifies who this Ezra is, but it also gives us a context about where it is that he comes from and who he really is. As we think about preparing our hearts, let's first look at Ezra's family tree. Begin reading with me, if you would, there in verse 1 of Ezra chapter 7. Now, after these things, again, about 50 years after all of the events of the temple dedication and the Passover and so forth, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Seraiah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Shalom, the son of Zadok, the son of Ahitub, the son of Amariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Merioth, the son of Zariah, the son of Uzi, the son of Buki, the son of Abishaiah, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the chief priest, this Ezra. What Ezra? This Ezra, right? This Ezra came up from Babylon, and he was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. The king granted him all his requests according to the hand of the Lord his God, which was upon him. Now, this is an incomplete genealogy that we're given in verses 1 through 5, but it's enough for the author's purpose in identifying Ezra. Some of these people we know absolutely nothing about except that they are in this genealogy and the similar one that is found in the book of Chronicles. Others share a name with a famous character who also is part of the ancestry of Ezra, like Zadok. We usually think about Zadok, the high priest of David, but this is a different Zadok mentioned here. But there are others that we know quite a lot about. And of those, they're really quite impressive. This is an amazing family that is described here. It begins with Aaron. Aaron, who was the brother of Moses, a spokesperson of God, who carried with him the authority from God. Why is so much talked about in the Old Testament and the descriptions of Aaron and the things that he did? His rod, or maybe your translation says his staff, but rod is probably more accurate. Why does it talk about that so much? His rod becomes a snake, remember, and eats up Pharaoh's snakes. His rod is the one that turned the water to blood in the Nile River. His rod is the one that budded to prove that the priestly line was through Aaron, and it was his rod that was kept in the Ark of the Covenant. Well, a rod is symbolic of authority. And Aaron had the authority from God as the spokesman of God for Moses. And Aaron's failings are well known to all, most notably the golden calf at Mount Sinai. But seemingly where Aaron failed, despite his greatness, his sons and grandsons succeeded. His son Eleazar succeeded Aaron, and he didn't partake in the sins of his older brothers, Nadab and Abihu, but he served God faithfully, beginning in the wilderness and all through the capture of the promised land. And during the life of Joshua, Eleazar was the high priest. And he was a faithful servant of God. And what's interesting is, when we think about the book of Joshua, that book ends not with Joshua's death, but the last recorded thing in the book of Joshua is the death and burial of Eleazar, the faithful high priest for all of these years. Eleazar's son is well known to us as well, Phinehas. This is the Phinehas who is synonymous with zeal in the Old Testament. He intervened when the people of Israel joined themselves to Baal, and a plague broke out upon the people because of their fornication against God and with the Moabite women. And by his stand for truth, that plague was stopped and the people were saved. And for his faith in action, he receives one of the highest commendations from God in all of the Bible. In the Old Testament, only two characters do the Scriptures say about them that it was accounted to him for righteousness to all generations forevermore. Abraham and this Phinehas. In fact, God made a covenant with Phinehas that his descendants would be a perpetual priesthood, even thinking of Ezra far into the future. We think about other characters that are less well known to us, like Azariah. Azariah was the high priest who stood up to King Uzziah of Judah when he wanted to burn sacrifices in the house of the Lord. He sees the king go into the temple and he follows after him and he says, "You're not going to do this. This is wrong." And the king is struck by God with leprosy. We think about Hilkiah. Hilkiah is the high priest who finds the book of the Lord that was lost in the house of the Lord in the days of Josiah. And some even believe that it was perhaps Hilkiah or the high priest who were before him who hid the book there to begin with. You look at Ezra's family and you say, this is a family that is known for faithfulness and zeal and law keeping and restoration and standing up for what is right in front of kings and in front of angry mobs of people. These are men who speak the very words of God. That's Ezra's legacy. Oh yeah, that Ezra, right? This is the Ezra that we're talking about. Now, we would say in West Texas that Ezra came from good stock, right? Ezra had this family legacy to live up to. And may I suggest that Ezra had all sorts of advantages because of the family into which he was born. And there is some very practical application to be made there. Because so many people sitting in the audience this morning, and may I suggest one standing in the audience as well, in the congregation, we have great advantage because of the family into which we were born. Or perhaps the family into which we were adopted. That we have people who love us. That we have people who care about our souls. That we have people who are trying to influence us and people who are trying or did try to bring us up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If you're sitting here this morning, you're loved and your family or someone wants you to know God and to have a relationship with Him. And you have wonderful opportunities to worship and to learn about Jesus. And if you ask, or even if you didn't, you could go everywhere to be with other people who want to worship Jesus. Young people, you could ask your parents, and perhaps they don't ask you. Maybe they just take you to be around other young people, to influence you for what is right and for what is good. And that is an enormous advantage to you. That you might know God at an early age and that you might be prepared to face so many of the trials and temptations that come upon us all. But despite that great advantage that you have and that Ezra had, despite that great family, Ezra did indeed come from a great family, but he still had to prepare his heart. And that's exactly what he did. You think about this genealogy, what does that prove about Ezra? It doesn't prove anything except that he was born into this priestly line and he was born into this family of high priests. Now, it actually deviated just before it gets to Ezra in regard to high priests, and so Ezra wouldn't have been a high priest, but he did come from this family. And despite wearing this family name of being from the family of Aaron and the tribe of Levi, he still had to make some choices in his life about what he was going to do. And what he chose to do was to become a scribe, to become an expert in the law of God, a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. He prepared his heart to study the law of the Lord, to do it, and to teach others also. He chose to return to Israel. He chose to rebuild the law of the Lord. He chose to do something very difficult for God and for His people when He could have just lived in comfort. He chose to prepare His heart. May I suggest we all have to make that same choice. No matter where we come from, no matter how good or bad our family might have been, there comes a time where we have to make the choice ourselves. And I can't make that choice for you. The elders can't make that choice for you. Your parents can't, or your grandparents, or your boyfriend, or your girlfriend, or your spouse, or your friends. It is your choice, and ultimately it has to be your faith. That you decide for yourself that I am going to serve the Lord. We sang just before this lesson, "Dare to stand like Joshua." As for me As for me and as for my house, those who are under my rule, we will serve the Lord. And he's just got through saying, you need to serve the Lord. That's what's going to be good for you. That's what's going to be right. But I can't make you do it. You have to decide. But let everybody know, as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord. And whatever your age, when you reach that time in your life when you know what sin is, when you can read and study and you know what Jesus has done for you, you have a choice to make. You have a choice to make whether to submit to God and to follow His way or to follow your heart in a different direction. You can't borrow another person's faith. And that begins with dedicating your life to Jesus, becoming a Christian. You have to do it because it's between you and God. Not because your parents want you to, not because you feel pressure from other people, but because you're going to devote your life to serving Him. That you are preparing your heart for a life filled with service. What an awesome family Ezra came from. But ultimately, it was his choice about the way he was going to live his life. Well, what does it mean, this idea of preparing your heart? Well, may I suggest this morning that there are two things, at least, that are included in that idea of preparation of your heart. The first is to be totally resolved. Maybe your translation says that he set his heart. Think about it in these terms. Maybe it's around Christmas time or birthday time, and you have a gift that you really, really want. We use that phrase, right? I had my heart set on it. Well, that's exactly what Ezra is doing here. He has his heart set on it. He wants that more than anything else. This is what I really want. And even more, I want it so bad, I'm going to work in order to do that. Ezra was resolved, if we might use that word, to do these things. Maybe your translation is a paraphrase like the NED or the NIV. It says, he dedicated himself or he devoted himself to these things. This is what his life was about. This was his focus. This was his purpose. This was his goal in life. The power of resolve cannot be overstated. God gave us an awesome power, each and every one of us. That power is free will. God says, I'm not going to make you do anything. You have a choice. You can decide for yourself. And so Ezra exercised his power of free will toward God. And he decided, this is what I'm going to do. I am totally resolved. And before Ezra actually did anything, he decided what he was going to do. And nothing was going to stop him from doing it. Really, that's that second thing. Yes, we need to have resolve to do these things, but we need to have some sort of plan. We need to have some goals in mind in how we're going to accomplish the things that we have resolved to do. If you know me, this probably doesn't come as a great shock to you, but I might be shocked that it might to some. To be honest, I am not a planner. I'm not an organized person. Naturally, I'm a fly-by-the-seat-of-my-pants sort of guy. Steph is the planner in the family, and I thank God for that almost all of the time. And I think part of the reason why I'm not a planner is I'm just kind of naturally, my personality is I'm an eternal optimist. I just kind of figure things are going to work out, and usually things kind of work out, and that's a good thing, I suppose. So imagine my surprise when my in-laws were in the last time for Stephanie's surgery, her gallbladder surgery, and Steve and I, my father-in-law, are sitting around the table. And we're discussing a number of different things. In fact, we have a project that's going on. We were adding a swing set to the Sky Fort I had built for the girls. And that wasn't a one-man job, but a two-man job. So we decided we were going to do that. And we were talking about a number of different things in that regard. And he says, now, Reagan, you're the kind of guy who plans his work and works his plan. And I said, do what? And in fact, what I really wanted to do was say, hey, Steph, come here a second. Could you repeat that to her so that she can hear that? And so I got to thinking about that. Does that mean my father-in-law doesn't know me? I don't think it does. In fact, I think we're pretty close after almost 10 years, right? But he knows me in a context, doesn't he? Like we know most people. You know somebody at work, you know them in a work context. Family, you know them in a family context. He knows me in a context of three different things where I do. I plan my work and I work my plan. He knows me in the context of preaching. He's a preacher, I'm a preacher, and we talk about preaching a lot. And so in regard to those things that are really important, we need to plan for those things that are really important. And that's the context he knows me in. He knows me in preaching. And I am no more organized in any part of my life than my work. And I am frustrated that I am not more organized than I am. But I see and I appreciate the importance of being organized in this. Because this is important. This has eternal consequences. He knows me in the context of things that have to get done by a tight deadline. We always have some project going on, either at our house or at his house, over Thanksgiving. We put siding over all of his house, and that was a big project, and we only had a few days to get it done, so what did I do? I called ahead of time, make sure we had all the supplies. I made sure that there weren't any tools that I needed to bring. I made sure that we had a schedule worked out so that we knew when we were going to work so that we could get that project done. We had a deadline. We had to get it done. And then he also knows me in the context of those things that have to be done right the first time. You think about that swing we were adding on. I don't want to rebuy lumber. So we have to get this right the first time. We have to have some plan on what it is we're going to do. When you look at that, those three things, that's life, isn't it? You think about something that is really important, things that have to get done by a certain deadline, things that must be done the first time, that is your life. And it's my life, too. How we live our lives is going to determine our eternity. That's how important it is. Are we planning for it? Turn to Luke chapter 12 and verse 16 for just a moment. Luke chapter 12 and verse 16. Somebody yells out from the crowd as Jesus is teaching. And he says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me." And you almost think, were you listening to Jesus? That's like in a class maybe where the student yells out some random question. That's not even what we're talking about. And that's the case here. And so Jesus asks and he says, well, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you? In a physical sense. He says, that's not where our focus needs to be. Your focus needs to be on spiritual things, not physical things. He tells him to beware of covetousness, and then he speaks a parable, verse 16. The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no room to store my crops? So he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Was he planning? Yeah, he was planning for the future. He was planning for his retirement. Right? But what does God say about that? Verse 20. But God said to him, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have prepared? He was planning and preparing, but for all the wrong things. Not the things that were really important. Verse 21, the application is made by Jesus. So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Selfish planning that does not consider God, that does not consider eternity, that does not consider spiritual things is foolish. But what kind of planning are we involved in? In our life, are we planning for eternity? Aside from the innocents, the only other people in heaven are going to be those who planned to be there. And there will be lots of people, I believe, in hell who didn't plan to go there, who had no intention of being there, but there will be no people in heaven who said, I didn't plan to be here, but what a happy surprise, right? If we want to be there, We have to plan now. We think about things that have to be done by a tight deadline. That's life, right? We say, well, we have all of these years. Let's say that we have 80 years to accomplish all the things we need to do in life. And yet, how short is that in comparison to eternity? This life is described as a vapor, as a flower, as the grass of the field. It is here today. It is gone tomorrow. And James asked the question in this way in James chapter 4 and verse 14, "For what is your life?" This life that we pour so much into, that is so important to us. He says, "It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." Life is like seeing your breath on a cold day. You see it, and it's there, and then it's gone. There's a deadline, an expiration date for all of us. We need to plan so that we get the things done in this life we need to do to be ready for the next. And there are no second chances in this life. We have to get it right the first time. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27 says, "It is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment." It's appointed for us to die once because we only live once. We only get one chance at any of this. This is it. And so this really does describe life. But even more, may I suggest that it describes parenting even more? Isn't that parenting, in a nutshell, something that is really important, something that has to be done by a deadline, something that you have to get done right the first time? One of our favorite places to eat in Lufkin, or the world, is Moe's. We have a Moe's here, a burrito place. It went in at the Pilot gas station. I promise it is not gas station food. It is the only Moe's I've ever seen in a gas station. But we go in there pretty often. We're on a first-name basis with a lot of the staff, so trying to have an influence on them, right? Because it is a gas station, you have all of these kind of migrant people, you know, truck drivers and people on vacation and so forth. And they see us, our little family, sitting there with our girls. And I can't tell you how many times people have come up to us and started talking about their families that are back home or their girls that they had. And you ask, well, how old are your girls now? Well, if they're 30, they're 45. And over, people tell us, over and over and over, enjoy these years, they're over before you know it. Everybody says that, right? We just get tired of hearing it. Is that true? Is that true? Now, what do I say to the high school kids? Let me hear your head rattle. Is that true? A lot of you have experienced that very thing, haven't you? Parents, are you planning spiritually for your family? Because we only get one shot. And there is a deadline that is counting down. And it is one of the most important works that we can do in this life. Sometimes the things that we should be planning for, setting goals for, are painfully obvious, but we still miss them. And we can acknowledge from the start how important that is, how we need to be planning for it, and yet we don't, right? When I was preaching in Lindale, there was a young couple there who had dated in high school, and they got engaged, and they were still just teenagers. They didn't have anything. They didn't have any education. They didn't have much of anything. And so it was a little bit awkward because everybody felt like they probably shouldn't be getting married yet, but here they were. They were engaged. So what do? Do you congratulate them? Well, most people did, right? Congratulations, so happy for you, and so on and so forth. Well, one of their peers, and I think she was 17 or 18 at the time. They were 18 and 19, maybe. One of their peers comes up. Her name is Jessica. And Jessica, you know those no-filter people who just kind of say whatever's on their mind? She goes up to them and she says, "Well, where are you going to live?" And they just kind of look back at her dumbfounded because they had no idea. All they knew is that they were in love and that they were going to make it work. Well, they have made it work so far, but sometimes the questions are that obvious. Where are you going to live? What are you going to do spiritually to prepare your children, to prepare your family for the days that are ahead? Do we need someone to ask the obvious questions for us? Have we considered the decisions that we make from a spiritual perspective as it relates to our soul? Well, let's consider some areas of our physical life from this angle. What plans do we need to make spiritually for the immediate future? What are our goals for ourselves individually spiritually, but also for our families? And let me say this before we get started in that. If you or your family are expecting church services, whether it's once or twice or three times a week, to be your only spiritual activity, it is not enough. It is not enough for us to be everything that God has called us to be. We need to prepare our hearts for a lifetime filled with service to God and work in His kingdom. Let's look at four areas that we don't generally associate necessarily with spiritual things, but where we need to be planning spiritually. On the back of your handout are some blanks for you to consider. And what I would ask you to do is to take this home, sit down with your spouse perhaps, or sit down in a quiet place by yourself. Young people, I want you to go through this exercise. I know a lot of times we talk about going back to school and here are some things that you need to do. And if you ask a week later, do you remember what those things are? Well, write them down and remember them. Put them up somewhere so that you might have these things to refer back to. I've listed four areas. Now, we could do more than that, but let's just look at these four. Work, education, extracurricular activities, and leisure. First, with work. And I'll talk to the young people first. Young people, some of you are getting jobs and you're starting to work, and that's a good thing, and that's a godly thing. And you need to learn how to work, and you need to learn good work ethic, and you need to know what it's like to have a boss and all of those things so that you're prepared for those things, and so you can work heartedly unto the Lord. But it also gives you an opportunity, while you're not providing for yourself in a real sense, you can start making some of those decisions now regarding spiritual things. Am I going to miss services for this job? Am I going to be asked to compromise? And if I am asked to compromise, what am I going to do when that occasion takes place? And for all of us, we need to ask ourselves questions about our employment. Is this interfering with my spiritual life in some way? Do I have a choice about that interference one way or another? Is this interference temporary or is it permanent? We all know the sorts of things that might take place in our jobs to lead us down that road. There's a good friend of mine who's a Christian. He's about 10 years older than me. And he has worked and worked diligently from an early age. He knew exactly what he wanted to be. He knew exactly what he wanted to do with his life. And there are probably some seniors in the audience who are thinking, I wish that were me. But he knew. He knew from an early age exactly what he wanted to do, and he worked, and he worked hard. And before you know it, a few years ago, he got his dream job, what he always wanted to be. Well, he has a family. He's a good Christian man. And in the course of this dream job, he's been asked to travel much, much more than what he expected. And so his wife actually told me that not too long ago he sat the whole family down. And he loves what he does and he doesn't want to do anything else selfishly, but he sits them down and he says, do I need to start looking for another job? Is this harming our family for me to do this? I was floored by that. But I shouldn't have been. Because he has prepared his heart for more important things than a dream job. And for all of us, we have to make that designation in our life, that determination in our life. Is this what I need to be doing for the Lord and for my family? And even more, as we talk about our work, are we looking for spiritual opportunities? Do we have spiritual goals with our influence in regard to our co-workers? Do we have someone picked out saying, this person, this name that I'm writing on this sheet, I'm going to have a spiritual conversation with this person in the next couple of weeks? Do we set those goals for ourselves, or do we fall into the routine that is so easy to fall into, that we just go and this is our job and we do what we're supposed to do and we work as hard as we can and then we come home to our family But there is nothing spiritual that is taking place for those 8, 9, 10 hours a day, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, whatever the case might be. We need to plan our work and work our plans spiritually in regard to our employment. And if we do, our life will be so much richer spiritually for it. What about in regard to education? We generally think about this in regard to young people. Parents, that's something that you need to be planning for with your children as school is about to begin. What are the goals spiritually for your child as they go back to school or they enter into another year of homeschooling? Where is the emphasis going to be placed? I've told the story before of a family I knew where I used to preach. And it was a good family, good, strong Christians by all accounts. They were always there. And so there was one Wednesday night where their son, who was in high school, a very good student and a very good Bible student, missed my class. And so I innocently go up to them and I say, "Well, where was so-and-so tonight?" And they said, "Well, he had a whole lot of homework tonight, so he just stayed home." Now, is missing that one night of Bible study, is that going to be the difference between heaven and hell and his eternal destiny? Probably not, right? But that reveals a lack of planning and a lack of focus as to what is most important. We want our children to succeed and excel educationally, but not at the expense of spiritual things, whatever that might be. And even more as we think about what we're going to do, young people, with your education. Are you making sure that when you go off to college, there's a strong church there and you get plugged in as soon as you can? Are you making sure that what it is you want to do with your life is going to be something that is going to be pleasing to God? Extracurricular activities. I forget exactly the way Mark worded it before the Lord's Supper, but we are so busy, aren't we? And we choose for it to be so, but most of those things are good, and most of those things are certainly not inherently sinful. But are we planning for spiritual things in regard to all of these activities that we're involved in and that our children are involved in, whether it's ball or our hobbies or whatever the case might be? And even more, are we striving to incorporate spiritual things into those activities to where we're using the opportunities that are provided for us to turn the focus toward a more spiritual idea? And then what about our leisure? Maybe this is just our daily free time, our me time at the end of the day when all of the family is home and together. Or maybe it's something planned like a vacation. Do we make plans for spiritual things in regard to that free time that we have? Do we talk about God with our children? Is prayer and Bible study a daily part of our routine in this time that we have? All of this begins by preparing our hearts. By preparing our hearts to be totally resolved to put spiritual things first. And if, like Ezra, we resolve in our hearts, if we prepare ourselves by saying, "I'm going to do what God wants me to do first and foremost, no matter what," that will lead us to plan and prepare our action to make sure that it lines up with what is most important in our hearts. Jesus tells us in the Sermon on the Mount, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." What is it that you value most? What is it that you treasure most? It is my prayer and it is God's desire that you would value Him most, and that that would be revealed in your heart and in your life. There's something that we can do to help you in that regard this morning. Won't you come? While together we stand and while we sing.